Well, welcome to this second in the series of the LSE's European lectures this term. My name's Roger Liddell. I'm a visiting fellow in the European Institute, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce Robert Cooper, who's going to address us on the subject of Can Europe Run the 21st Century? Well, that's a very challenging question. My day job at the moment is in the cabinet of Peter Mandelson in the Commission. And at the moment, it doesn't quite feel as though Europe is likely to be running the 21st century, given the collapse of the constitutional treaty, given the what the our Prime Minister called in his conference speech the malaise in France and the angst in Germany, given the figures on falling productivity and unemployment, and given the fact that when we faced a major international crisis as in Iraq, Europe proved to be at sixes and sevens. So it's a very, very challenging question, this. But there's no better person to answer challenging questions than Robert. Robert, I first met in government in 1997, when as a very new and innocent advisor, I took on the business in the among the Downing Street political staff of doing Europe. And it was quite interesting at the time, because after a couple of months, we suddenly came up with the wonderful idea that if you were going to do Europe, it might be a good idea to talk to some other Europeans. It hadn't actually sort of occurred to many people before that, but this is what I was sent out to do. And the first place I went was Bonn, where Robert was then very grandly titled the British Minister in Bonn. We got to know each other there, and we had many enjoyable times in discussions with what was then the tail end of the Kohl government, and also with the Social Democrats who were about to take power. I used to try and tell them about the lessons of New Labour and how they should adopt them. Unfortunately, they only half listened. And I think perhaps that explains the situation today. Robert is one of our great public intellectuals in Britain. Not only does he have a very busy job, after he was minister in Bonn, he went off to be the deputy secretary in the cabinet office, at a time of great moves forward in areas like European defence, for which he was responsible. He then tried to devise a policy for Afghanistan after September the 11th. Then went off to work for Javier Solana, the Secretary General of the Council of Ministers, Europe's putative foreign minister, as his chief policy advisor. And one of the great things about Robert, he's one of the few people I know who actually likes the fact that he's exchanged the luxuries of the British ambassadorial life, the Rolls Royce, the wonderful house, all those lovely dinners, for a pretty miserable job in an under-resourced, overworked environment in one of the ugliest buildings in Brussels. I think we're all grateful to him that he made that choice, and we're grateful to him that he has time to come along and talk to tonight. I'm sure you've read some of the things that Robert has written. He has the great merit of writing beautifully. He also has the wonderful merit of writing briefly and succinctly, and I'm sure that's what we're going to get tonight in this lecture. So, Robert, thank you very much for coming along.
Well, there are times working inside institutions, one sees things. Sometimes one sees the seamier side, and you see the flaws. And so I was saying to Roger before this lecture began, maybe the title should be not "Can Europe Run the 20th Century?" but "Can Europe Run a Piss Up in a Brewery?" But there are times when the other title is worth, when the other question is worth asking too. I must say, I thought to myself over the last year that when we saw books coming out, Jeremy Rifkin's what's it called, The European Dream. Jeremy Rifkin's European Dream, and then Mark Lennon's Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century. I thought to myself, this stock is beginning to peak. It's probably a moment to sell. And sure enough, the bottom then drops out of the market. But like the dot-com boom, actually there's still something there. And it may be that the dot-com boom peaked and that a lot of the shares are worthless, but somewhere, some of those companies are actually still going to run the 21st century. There was a time when perhaps one might have thought in terms of Europe running the world. In the 19th century, Europe did almost run the world. One could ask the question whether, without the great European wars, Europe might have run the world, where the European empires might have spread and been permanent. It was, in fact, European wars that ended that possibility, not just the wars of the 21st century. It really began with the Seven Years' War, the war between, essentially, between Britain and France, which was a colonial war. At the end of the Seven Years' War, the main result of the Seven Years' War was first that Britain got control of India, but the other result of the Seven Years' War was that the French were defeated on the American continent, and that made it safe for the American colonists to rebel against Britain and get rid of Britain. And then you have the Napoleonic Wars, which were the moment when the South American countries began to think that they could liberate themselves. And then in the 20th century, the Great War, the First World War, was the war that finished with the Versailles Conference, finished with the idea of self-determination as being the governing idea. And for me, this has been the governing idea of the 20th century. The beginning of the 20th century, the world was empires. The end of the 20th century, the world was states. And I sometimes illustrate the power of this idea by reminding people that during the Versailles Conference, a kitchen worker in the Ritz Hotel wrote to Woodrow Wilson petitioning self-determination for his country. Well, his name was Ho Chi Minh, and it took him a long time to get it, but he did. And that is, for me, an illustration of the power of the idea of self-determination. And you could say that this came about because of the European wars, actually going back to the Seven Years' War and the Napoleonic Wars. I think that it was probably going to happen anyway. I think that there was a logic in liberalism that would have led to self-determination, whatever had happened. And even, it wasn't just the wars that brought self-determination, it happened anyway. In the British Dominions, Canada and Australia were already beginning in the middle of the 19th century in a peaceful way to separate themselves from Britain. Norway was separating itself from Sweden. So I think that the idea, even, that the European empires of the 18th and 19th century could have run the world is probably fantasy. In that sense, and I'll say this again later, in that sense, it seems to me to be unlikely that that anybody, any single country or group of countries could run the world. Actually, the result of the European wars of the 20th century was that Europe didn't even run itself. In order to solve the problem that Europe had created, the context was enlarged. The USA came in on the one side, Russia came in on the other side, Europe was divided. With the end of the Cold War, we are tentatively moving back to a Europe which does run itself, not, of course, separate from the USA, but nevertheless, which can think in terms of a higher degree of autonomy, which in a way seems to me to be the natural and desirable order of things. To come back to the question, if Europe can run itself, can it in some way run the world? Well, there are a couple of other ways in which you could take that question. One is the idea of Europe as a superpower. And perhaps you could imagine it, a European army, one hears the phrase sometimes in the press. Actually, one hears it a lot in the anti-European press, because in practice nobody is thinking of any such thing. It's a fantasy of the Eurosceptics. It would be possible, in a way, to create a European army without enormous difficulty. Armies with speaking different languages have functioned from time to time. Wellington's army at Waterloo consisted of a number of different allies. The Austro-Hungarian army spoke various different languages. And indeed, the British army invented the regimental system because it was so difficult for people from one part of England to understand people from another part of England. Provided you have a unified general staff, you could run a European army. The reason why I don't think this is going to happen is because I don't think that there's going to be a European state. Armies belong to states. The decision to send an army in somewhere is a very serious decision, requires very serious legitimacy, risking people's lives. Isn't something that you can do without knowing that you have got the backing of the people in some way. I don't believe that there's going to be a European state. I don't believe there will be a European Parliament in the sense that there are national parliaments. So I don't believe that there will be a European army. I don't think that we have the political structure for that. I pause to point out that there's a curious paradox that while legitimacy is more easily come by in the national context through national parliaments, that to authorize military action, almost every case requires some kind of authorization from a national parliament. In the international field, action by single governments is not seen very much as being legitimate. People would much prefer even a peacekeeping force to be multinational rather than mononational. So we have a curious paradox that the use of force needs to be authorized at a national level, but the forces are probably going to be seen internationally as being more legitimate if they're multinational. But I don't think that we are going to have a European state. And I don't think that, therefore, we're going to have a European army. And even if we did, it would require an enormous effort of defence spending to bring the army up to the kind of level of the USA, not just raising defence budgets enormously, but doing that over quite a number of years. The military power of the USA is not just a result of the $500 billion that are spent this year by the Pentagon. They're a result of having spent at those sort of levels over a period of 10 or 20 years. So even if you want to imagine this European army and you want to imagine it on the scale of the USA's military, it would take a long time to get there. And when you've got there, I find it pretty difficult to imagine Europe authorizing aggressive military action anywhere in the world. But even if you imagine all of those things, I find it even more difficult to imagine that aggressive military action succeeding, because surely one of the great lessons of the Iraq War is visible in Fallujah, where you see the greatest military power in the history of the world unable to control a medium-sized town. Why? The answer is because of self-determination, to come back to what I was saying earlier. So the vision of Europe as superpower in the military sense running the 21st century doesn't really work for me either. That's hard power. What about Europe running the 21st century with soft power? I'm a bit skeptical about the idea of soft power generally, because I find the idea rather imprecise. Liking Hollywood films isn't the same thing as liking the USA. Kim Jong-il is a great fan of Hollywood. And I think that Saddam Hussein particularly liked The Godfather. And liking Hollywood films doesn't make the USA powerful. There are a lot of people wearing jeans, a kind of American-style icon, protesting against USA. In fact, most people protesting against the USA are probably wearing American-style clothes. So that notion of soft power has never really seemed to me to be a very powerful one. I do think there is something called soft power, and I think it's actually it's a kind of new word for legitimacy. I do think that there is a kind of power that is conferred by creating legitimate institutions. And Europe has influenced, has exercised fantastic soft power. By offering countries a seat at the table. The place where Europe has had real influence has been in its immediate neighbourhood, among the countries that think about joining the European Union or attracted by joining the European Union. The constitutions of many Central European countries have been rewritten to fit in with the European model. Their legislation has been changed to fit in with the European model. They've adopted anti-corruption programs, and this is still going on at the moment. Turkey, we've seen over the last 3 years, go through a revolution, abolishing the death penalty, giving language rights to the Kurds, very tough programs for training judges, eliminating torture. All of these things in the interest, eventually, of getting a seat at the European table. That, it seems to me, is real soft power, real power to change things. And that is, soft power, in this sense, is sharing power. There's a Latin tag which could well apply to Europe. Bella gerent alii. Felix Austria Nube, let others wage war, Austria, happy Austria is the bride. Austria increased its power by intermarriage, by acquiring kingdoms by a kind of conjugal merger, which was a kind of, you could say that was the dynastic equivalent of enlargement of the European Union. And there's a certain paradox in Austria being the country concerned. It does seem to me that this is actually fantastically powerful. there are two European miracles. The first European miracle is that we've stopped fighting each other. Everyone has forgotten about that miracle completely, but it reverses 1,000 years of history. The second European miracle is that the revolutions of 1989 in Central Europe ended in stable democratic countries. That's not what happens to revolutions normally. And the reason why it happened was because of the context of this community of democracies on the borders of Central Europe. It's the greatest achievement, I think, of the European Union, perhaps apart from the first miracle. And it's somehow typical of the world that just at the moment when you achieve something really strategically, historically important, that people reject it. But that's what's happened in Central Europe. The transformation of Turkey that's going on at the moment is a part of that same story. And you can see the same thing happening gradually in the Balkans. The story of the week is Turkey, but the Council of Ministers that I was at earlier this week, by the way, there's a European directive, I believe, which says you're supposed to work 48 hours a week and no more. All I can say is that I passed my 48 sometime during Wednesday. But that was partly because of the exceptional circumstances of the negotiations about the final agreement about Turkey. But at the same time, during that meeting of the Council of Ministers, we also made two important decisions. One was to open negotiations with Croatia, and the other was to start the process that will eventually lead towards enlargement with Serbia and Montenegro. And strikingly, I heard today, it had happened last night, the Republika Srpska in Bosnia agreed a critical reform yesterday, which is going to put them on the path towards integration as well. That's because they saw something else happening in the Balkans, didn't want to be left behind. That's real power. That's changing constitutions, that's bringing the rule of law, that's bringing democracy. And that's not done with armies at all. That's done with enlarging the European Union. The question is whether there are limits to that. And this is a question which is debated now and will continue to be debated. There is another fantasy. The first fantasy is the fantasy of Europe as a military superpower. The second fantasy, which is even more fantastic, is Europe enlarging forever. And you could construct this story because Turkey, with some difficulty, becomes a member of the European Union. Not difficult to imagine, if that happens, that Ukraine also becomes a member of the European Union. But, of course, you have a bit of a problem with Turkey because there's a Kurdish population there. If you really want to resolve the Kurdish problem, then perhaps you'd better do what's happened with the Irish problem and take in the other countries who also have Kurdish populations. So that brings you in Iraq and Iran and Syria, probably. And perhaps around this time somebody has decided to consolidate the Israel-Palestine peace by taking them into the European Union. I don't think that this is going to happen either. This seems to me to be another fantasy. Even if you may imagine that, it's pretty difficult to go south of the Sahara. So Europe running the world through ever-increasing enlargement, at the very least, I would say that's not for the 21st century. It would take a bit longer. In Mark Leonard's book, which I guess is where the title of this lecture comes from, he talks of Europe running the 21st century, not in the sense of controlling the 21st century through empire of some description or other, either the hard empire of force or the soft empire of law, but through the spread of the European model. And that does seem to me to be a more interesting idea, a more possible idea. The European model is not, though, as far as I'm concerned, is not the European social model. I don't think that there is a European social model. At least it doesn't reveal itself in the tables of competitiveness, which have Finland at number one and Italy somewhere else. And if you just think around European countries, think of Estonia with its flat tax, Austria, a very successful country with an enormous amount of state-owned industries, almost party-owned industries. Finland and Sweden, also with highly, in some sense, socialized economies, a great deal of high taxation, high social protection, but very competitive as well. And then Ireland, with much less of both, but also very competitive. The whole range of models. There's no European social model. Now, I'm thinking of the what you might call the European model of relations among states. The problem of getting people to live together without violence is solved by creating constitutions, by creating rules that allow people to live together, by creating states. Unfortunately, when you've created states and you've stopped people from fighting each other, you find that the states fight each other. So what's the next step? The next step in Europe has been to create rules for states, and that's really what the European Union consists of. It's rules for states. And that works. It doesn't abolish the states. On the contrary, by having common rules that govern trade and investment and govern their relations to some extent between each other, it enables them to function better. But the states are still there, and the states are still the main political actors in Europe. That's what, as far as I'm concerned, that's the European model. It's a kind of it's a meta system for states. In a way, sometimes I think that the European Union is the real inheritor of Woodrow Wilson's idea. The League of Nations somehow has acquired a bad name because it was a failure. But if you think of the way in which people thought of the League of Nations when it was proposed at Versailles, it was, why were countries not going to fight each other? The answer was actually nothing to do with somebody with collective security. The real answer that Wilson and everybody gave is they said, they'll never do it because public opinion won't let them. That, in a way, is the answer that exists today in the European Union. Nobody would dream of having a war inside the European Union. Nobody would. It's not imaginable. And that is a real sense in which you could say public opinion wouldn't let them. But that's what the League of Nations was meant to be. And it's a system of rules for states, and you've created a community of states in which war has become unthinkable. And this seems to be unpopular at the moment, strangely, in Europe, in spite of the fantastic benefits that it's brought. Not having wars is an important benefit. On 9/11, just under 3,000 people were killed. On the average day in World War II, 17,000 people were killed. And World War II went on for 17 years. So the benefits of peace, not to be underestimated, and the prosperity that you just have through continuous peace, not to be underestimated. But Europe's also actually quite popular in the rest of the world. And stupidly, I didn't bring computer graphics with you, or I could have shown you, but the numbers are not that complicated. A survey across 22 countries put the question, do you think the following are a good or a bad influence in the world? And do you rate them positively or negatively? And they added the things up, and they came up with, well, starting with here, Britain, a balance 21% positive. 21% more people thought Britain was positive influence in the world than thought it was negative. A dead heat with China, which achieved approximately the same ratings. France did rather better, 39% positive rating. Russia was minus one, the balance was negative. USA was minus seven. The UN scored plus 51, and Europe scored plus 55. Now, I don't know how well informed the people were, but it shows that there's kind of that this image of a rule-governed group of democracies who've stopped fighting each other, it has some attraction. And indeed, further on in the same survey, they asked the question, how do you feel about Europe becoming more influential than the US in the world? And the world average for that came out 53% said, this is across all the 22 countries. Actually, if you take all 22 countries, including Europe, you get 58% thought that was a good thing, against 23% who thought that was negative. The figure that I found most striking in this survey was that in the USA, 55% thought that a Europe more influential than the USA would be negative. 34% thought it would be positive. So 34% of people in the USA would like to see more Europe more powerful than the United States. That shows that we have, at any rate, generated an image of being, on the whole, a kind of decent, harmless bunch of people. The idea of Europe is, those are public opinion surveys which shouldn't be taken that seriously, but the idea is still taken quite seriously in other places. You see in Latin America successive attempts through organizations like the Andean Pact or Mercosur to create something like the European Union. It's a dream in Latin America to be something like the European Union. In ASEAN, although they almost certainly wouldn't admit it, they look at the European Union and wonder which bits of it they can take. In Africa, the African Union is actually quite consciously modelled on the European Union. So there is a sense in which people would like to copy the European Union. I don't think that that's going to work, because I think the world is various. But I do think we learn a bit from each other, and there's a creative process in which you try to copy and it doesn't work and you adapt it a bit or you misunderstand it a bit. And so perhaps in that sense the European model will spread. But for me the core of the European model is about governing relations between states by negotiation and law. There is at least a possibility that that in some form will catch on. That doesn't mean that it will happen easily or automatically, but if you can do it, and people are trying in ASEAN and in Mercosur with less success in Africa, if you can do it, then it works and it will continue. And that means, in that sense, the European model, Europe running the 20th century, means a world run by law rather than by force. And even if that's not possible, it does at least seem extremely desirable. Perhaps the big question in the 21st century is going to be whether China decides that it wants to be more like Europe or more like the United States. So I stop there. I'm not sure I was as concise as Roger forecast, but that's roughly what I said.
Thank you. Well, there we have it. We can run the world because people will try to emulate us. Now, who would like to ask questions? I'll start right at the back over there.
Yes, thank you very much.
Could you tell us who you are?
Hi, I'm Max Fryer. I'm a research student with the European Institute. You said that the European Union is in effect a system that gives rules to the nation states to the member states. Considering that I, as a German citizen, could take part in elections in London or can appeal to a court if I feel that my rights are infringed, doesn't the European Union go considerably beyond this this model you've described to us? If you could comment on that, thank you very much.
It gives rights to citizens, but the rights are actually still given. The courts that you appeal to are essentially national courts, and the rights are delivered through national parliaments. And so there's a common set of rules which are agreed at the European level and which are implemented at the national level, and those apply to citizens as well. As it's not just rules about the relations between states, because that's not good enough. And so in that sense you're right. Perhaps the description is perhaps I gave a misleading description. It's creating, but it still is the creation of a community of law, which it governs more than relations between the states, and yet it's difficult to have laws just about the relations between states, but the effect of the laws is to govern the relations between the states.
Next point. Just hang on a second, while you're... Because people at the back won't be able to hear you, see? You speak up, yeah.
I don't think that the enlargement story is necessarily at an end. I don't believe in the ever expanding European Union, but I think that we're at a particular moment at the moment, I think there will be there may be times in the future, we'll see, when it will be when referenda on enlargement will succeed. So I don't think that that's necessarily the end of the story. Will it try to stabilize its neighborhood through hard power? Of course, it's possible that you could imagine scenarios in which there is a radical government or a breakdown of order somewhere on the borders of the European Union, and military action became necessary. I would be a little bit surprised if it was the European Union. I think that the European Union in this area, at least now, operates by consensus, and I don't think you will ever get consensus for that kind of military action. So I could imagine NATO, I could imagine a coalition of member states, probably not the European Union itself. Well, EU battle groups were actually created specifically in the context of rapid deployment on behalf of the United Nations, and they are actually quite small. I mean, these are groups of around 1,000, 1,500 men at the most. That's not the kind of force that you would need for the sort of operation I'm imagining. You think far enough into the future, it's possible to imagine anything, but These things are beyond my time horizon. I would add also, I'm pretty skeptical about small quantities of hard power. You know, we could have stabilized. We could have stabilized Yugoslavia if we'd been prepared to use a little bit of force early on. Maybe there could be such occasions like that. But that would still not just be hard power. That's hard power and soft power together.
Okay, I'm going to take the lady on the second row there.
Costanza Musu. If we look at the recent initiative,
did everybody get that? Iran and whether we're going to see more trilateralism, more directoire between France and Germany in foreign policy.
I don't think that it'll be quite as simple as that. If you look at Iran, which is a nuclear issue, maybe it's not a surprise that Britain and France are involved. Actually, I think it was Germany who took the initiative originally on this question. So it's not a surprise that they're involved. If you look at the brief but happy events in Ukraine, when was it? A year and a half ago. It was Poland and Lithuania. And my boss, Javier Solana. Actually, my boss is also involved in the Iran story as well. And so it does seem to me possible that there are always some countries who are more interested in one problem than others. If you look at what the European Union is doing in the Congo, which is kind of small but important, although I bet there are not many have heard of it here. You find that there is France, there is Belgium, there is UK, the Netherlands, maybe Sweden. For any situation, it's unlikely that all 25 are going to be as intimately concerned and involved. And it's likely that in any of those circumstances, although in the Ukraine case it wasn't, it's likely in most of those circumstances one or two of the big countries will be involved. But not for all of them. So I don't see the directoire model of Britain, France and Germany running things. I think much more likely that political different situations will attract different informal groups of countries.
Thanks. You didn't mention this in your talk, but in your book you make the point that Europe has entered what you call the postmodern world of kind of mutual transparency and trust. But you also make the point that the United States played an essential role in that process because, first of all, the security umbrella allowed European states to de-bellicize, as it were. And secondly, because in the world outside the postmodern world of Europe, America still plays a vital role in using force and so forth. So given that you don't see the European Union forever expanding and enlarging, does that mean that for the foreseeable future we'll still need, what role does the US play? Will we still need America's bad cop to Europe's good cop?
I would certainly be very reluctant to abolish the United States. I would feel a bit nervous about a world in which the US decided it was going to withdraw completely and close down all its overseas bases and shut down the Pentagon. There might come a day when that would be possible, but I think it's still quite a long while away. So I think that you're right. I still actually think that Europe has developed under a US umbrella of hard power. Until the kind of sort of imitation Europe in different ways that one would like to imagine around the world are really functioning, because I think that solutions to problems are almost always going to be regional. The solution to the Iraq question is going to be a regional solution, if there's a solution. It's going to involve Iran and Saudi Arabia and maybe Turkey and Syria and the Gulf states. Until you reach that happy state when stability and order and law have spread, I would still like to keep the possibility of major military force in the back pocket. And for the moment, the US very conveniently supplies that.
Morris.
Morris Fraser, European Institute. It's following on slightly from the previous questioner. Robert, if on the hopefully, on the not entirely fanciful assumption, hopefully, that what unites Europeans and Americans is much greater than what divides them, would it not be more interesting to ask the question whether the West can run the 21st century, or is that a rather outdated concept?
I don't think the concept's outdated in the sense that I think that in the sense that I agree with you that Europe and the USA still are enormously close and have enormous amount in common. I think the West is expanding in a way, because I think one can think of Japan as being a part of the West, for example. Part of what I was trying to say is that I don't think anyone will run the 21st century. I think the 20th century was the century of self-determination. The 21st century, if we're lucky, will be the century in which people find ways of making self-determination function at an international level. Now, and the European model is the best model we've got of making that happen. I don't see that as being a kind of Euro-American domination of the world. It may be the success of the European idea, but that's the success of an idea of a kind of autonomy within a rational cooperative framework.
Could I just come in on that? Because, I mean, do you think, Robert, that the on the sort of hard problems we face, let me say, like climate change or what we do about poverty in Africa, Europe can achieve much on its own without securing the active engagement of the United States, Muslim fundamentalism? Can we do much without successfully engaging America?
No, I don't think so. I think it depends a little bit on the problem, but the U.S. is such a powerful force in the world that if you've got the U.S. against something, then that more or less stops it. Not in every case, but there are rare cases, but they're not big ones. Having the U.S. for something makes a very big difference. Now, that may be less so in the future when other actors are playing a more prominent role. But for the moment, I don't think the big problems will be solved without the U.S. And it's especially true, I'm thinking particularly of security problems. Even if the U.S. is not directly involved, it's very important that people know that the U.S. is backing them. Problems in the Balkans were only solved when Europe and the U.S. were doing it together.
Someone at the back, right on the back, at the back over there.
Marco Dick, student at the Europe Institute. Do you think that the success of the European model is sufficient to make Europe's voice heard on the international stage? I think, for example, Iraq issue, of course.
Roger mentioned Iraq as a failure for Europe, which it was. Europe only has impact on the international level if it has a single voice. And on Iraq it didn't. It had two opposite voices, as it did earlier in the Balkans in the 1990s. Gradually there's a prisoner's dilemma story here, that gradually people have to learn that there are gains from cooperation, and that's learned, I think, by experience and by habit. The encouraging thing about Iraq is that it's been followed up by handling Iran in a different way in the European level. But the lesson won't last forever. It always has to be relearned.
David Sala, master student, European Institute. I have a question about the integrity of the European model. If the European model is to be one which is followed in the future, in the coming century, is there a danger that Europe might be, in a sense, drunk with its own exemplary power and try to create systems within Europe that other people might attempt, which would only be beneficial for Europe?
Such as?
Common agricultural policy. I think that sometimes the European model, I can tell you from inside it, and that's where I really my first remark, I can tell you it's a pretty creaky, ramshackle model. It just happens to be better than anything else we've tried. But it's an evolving model. I think that there are some quite big questions that haven't been solved. In particular, the question of legitimacy is something that hasn't been solved. But then I say to myself, in the 18th century, no one could imagine democracy on the scale of a large state. And I don't think Europe is going to become like a nation state and be a democracy in that way. But I think we have to begin to imagine other ways of being legitimate and democratic than the national way.
It's a good question. I didn't intend you to ask it, actually. So pass your microphone to the, to the lady on the front row here.
Ah. All right, fine.
Karen Smith from the International Relations Department. You made in your book, you distinguish quite nicely between the postmodern, modern, and pre-modern worlds, and you make a powerful argument that's saying Europe can't remain a postmodern paradise. It has to deal with the pre-modern world because the pre-modern world essentially will deal with it otherwise, and that one way of doing that is engaging, shall we say, with the rules of the jungle. Now, in the presentation you've given us today, this sort of pre-modern world kind of disappears. Now, are you arguing that Europe should simply not deal with the pre-modern world, or that somehow there is no more pre-modern world, and does it do it by force or by trying to spread law to places that are essentially lawless?
Yeah, well, that's a different lecture. I didn't answer the question. How do you spread the European model? I'm pretty sure you don't spread it by invading people. I think that it spreads itself. I think in the end that people make up their own minds and work out the best way to live. But I think they do learn from example. I think it's almost the most powerful force in history. I'm always been, you know, look at the way in which Europe itself evolved. The Netherlands invented something like modern society, and then Britain copied bits of it, and then Montesquieu wrote what he thought was a description of Britain, and the Americans copied that, and so on. I think that there is a learning process, and that's the way in which the model spreads. What do you do in the meantime when you've got dangerous people outside? The answer is occasionally you may have to invade them. You may have to take military action, but I think one should be very cautious about it because it always has unintended consequences. But there may be times when it's inevitable. It should be a last resort.
Well, the questions are still coming thick and fast. The lady in the middle there, I was overlooking you, I noticed.
Hi, my name is Arzu Kartel. I'm final year politics student at London Metropolitan. My question is that will the fact that Turkey is a Muslim country be an obstacle to its joining the EU? I'm thinking more in terms of policy implementations such as gay rights, women rights, and etc.
Yes, the question was, would the fact that Turkey, the questioner said, is a Muslim country, but I'm not sure, a country with a Muslim population is probably an accurate description, would that be a barrier to implementing European law, for example, women's rights and this kind of thing? I'm not sure that I know enough about Islam and about Turkey and law to answer the question completely, but I do know that the major revision of the Turkish criminal code that's just taken place changes, for example, changed the laws on rape dramatically, and what they proposed was found to be very unsatisfactory by a lot of women's groups in Turkey and was rewritten as a result. So the other thing, my knowledge is so limited, the only other thing I know about Turkey is that, like France, veils are not permitted in public places. I don't know if that's a woman's right or not, but it's certainly not a piece of Islamic law. So Turkey in that sense is not an Islamic country. It's not. The Turkish state is very determinedly secular, which is the grounds on which the headscarves are not permitted. Although on the other hand, the Turkish state seems to control the churches. The short answer is no. I don't think there is a problem with Islamic legal traditions. Does the fact that it's an Islamic state with a large Islamic population stop it from joining the European Union? I definitely don't think that it should. What the reaction among European populations will be, that's another matter. Will people feel a sufficient community of interest to accept Turkey as a member of the community? That's a question which will need to be answered in some years' time. But I think it will be quite a different Turkey then.
Thank you. Ben Prince, the Alliance Research Professor here. Robert, I refer you back to your rhetorical answer of two questions ago about legitimacy, because both you and the chairman started this evening with somewhat amusing self-deprecation, rehearsing all the profound systems failures which we've had in the formal European institutions just recently. I mean, one could have added more, the inability to turn in accounts that anybody can audit, the inability to agree a budget, and of course, as you've returned to it quite rightly, the fundamental issue, which is the inability to acquire the sort of belief that would underpin legitimacy. So I wanted to ask you to, I think the phrase of art is, push the envelope for your view of where your model might go. If we look towards what is increasingly thought of as the next likely major systems failure, which will be the collapse of the euro. So in the eventuality that that occurs, and we can already see in Eastern Europe the cold feet which are being felt in Poland and, of course, particularly in the Czech Republic, do you think that there will be a sudden dimming of the enthusiasm for the soft model that you put?
Maybe because I'm British and tend to operate in understatements and a slightly self-deprecating manner, maybe I've overdone the failures. I think of Europe as being a dramatic success, and of course there are failures day to day. That's life. And the question about institutions is not whether they always succeed. Any institution can survive if it's always successful. The question about institutions is how they deal with failure. And I think the European Union, which has a strong record of having failed this time that on many occasions, has a very strong record of overcoming it and finding other ways of going forward. If you look at the project of the single currency, to come to your question, you'll find that there were two or three failures before it actually happened. I'm not sure that I can imagine the collapse of the euro. clearly enough to know sort of what it would look like and what would happen. Is it the collapse of the currency in the sense that it goes through the floor in the exchange markets? I find it much easier to imagine the collapse of the dollar than the collapse of the euro at the moment. The collapse of the euro. I could imagine the collapse of the Italian bond market because everybody decides that, you know, why hold Italian bonds when you can hold German bonds instead in the same currency. But that's not the collapse of the, that would be a big crisis for the euro and for the eurozone. How would that be dealt with? I don't know. I'm not a currency man, and I hope they're thinking about this in Frankfurt, and they can call Anatol Kaletsky. I don't know. I think your question is a good question in the sense that I'm not sure that European institutions are very well equipped for handling very fast-moving crises like that. But maybe the central bank would be able to. But the problem with European institutions is that power is very diffuse, and that makes it very difficult to take dramatic decisions very quickly. So maybe there is a problem.
A lady on my far left, followed by the gentleman in the baseball cap.
Hello, my name is Dorin Mureșan. I come from Romania and I study MSc program in the government department, Department of Government. So my first question is, you mentioned that the European Union would not enlarge forever. Taking into consideration the improvements that the enlargement process brought to the countries, to the candidate countries and to the countries that hope to start negotiations, and also taking into consideration the fact that the power of the European Union also lies in this exporting of its governing model, how far do you think that the European Union should enlarge? And the second question, in the beginning of your speech, you mentioned that you don't envisage a European army as an army of the European Union. How far do you think that the idea of a common foreign policy is realistic? Thank you.
I deliberately didn't answer the question, how far should Europe enlarge? Because I think that's the answer to the question evolves with the European Union. The European Union is committed to enlargement to include all of the Balkan Peninsula. We have opened negotiations with Turkey, but those may not end in success. It will take a long time in either way. And there are clearly one or two other countries who have their eyes set on the European Union. But how that will evolve is a story about how Europe evolves, how the institutions evolve, how public opinion evolves. It's going to take, what I'm sure of, is that there's not going to be another dramatic round of enlargement in the near future. 10 countries plus Romania and Bulgaria take some digesting. But after that, there are more countries who are definitely on the path to enlargement from the Balkans. After that, we'll see. So I don't have an answer to that. Time will tell. Not very satisfactory, but more honest. Can you run a common policy without a single army? Yes. The armies do operate together. They operate together in Bosnia. And that it's essential to have a common policy if you're going to operate together. And actually, it's essential, ultimately, to be able to field military forces if you want to have a common policy. But the forces will continue to be owned by the national states. But they will operate. They will operate increasingly together, I hope. Hardly anybody does a military operation entirely on their own these days.
Gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Hussein Kozan, and I am from Turkey. The thing is, after the last minute deal on Monday evening, Mr. Jack Straw, the British Prime Minister, he made a speech, and I'm quoting, he said, "This is extremely, this is a historic day for Europe." And after listening to his first speech, he gave the impression that it was as if it was a, very important for Europe to have Turkey. Can you tell me what will Europe and indeed Britain will gain Turkey's membership?
What will Europe gain?
Yeah, from Turkey's membership and Britain as well.
The negotiations have begun. They won't end for some time. So I would phrase the question as, what would Europe gain from Turkey's membership? Because I don't think that the end of the negotiations is absolutely foreseeable. The first thing that Europe would gain is and for me, actually, the most important thing about opening the negotiations is that we're keeping our promises. What we would have lost by not opening the negotiations seems to me an enormous amount of credibility. We made promises over 40 years. What we would gain is we would gain a modern European Turkey on our borders. That seems to me, large country, seems to me to be an enormous gain for Europe, because to become a member of the European Union, Turkey will have to change, will become a European country, a fully European country. I think that's an enormous gain. That's a gain which will have influence, which will spread more widely in the region as well. I think that we gain more than that. I think that I've talked about, and others have referred to, that the power of enlargement. But it's not just what happens to you on the way to joining the European Union, it's what happens to you after you join the European Union as well. I'm very impressed by the transformation of Spain in the European Union. I think the key to the Irish peace process has been the transformation of Ireland from a sort of an ex-colony of Britain, a slightly embittered ex-colony of Britain, to being an equal member of a community of democracies, which found it had a lot of interests in common with Britain. So the transformation doesn't stop with membership, it continues. It continues afterwards, and I think we've seen Greece transformed as well. As you see, actually, Greece, by the end of the process, almost the strongest advocate of Turkish membership of the European Union. The primary gain is the transformation of Turkey itself. I don't think in terms of, people sometimes say Turkey would bring with it enormous assets in terms of strategic location and those kind of things. Those kind of things are no doubt useful. Good location for pipelines, for oil, and that sort of thing. But primarily, it's about the country itself.
Now, I'm going to take the lady on my right here, and then Charles Grant. Robert's been going for a good hour. Who else wants to ask a question after those two? Yeah. Gentlemen, there.
We collect a collection.
Right, okay, we'll try and take as many as we can, okay? Right.
Okay, my name is Sigrun Davidsdottir. I'm a journalist.
The balcony, yeah. Okay.
You ended on mentioning China, and I was just wondering, you know, running anything in the 21st century surely has to depend a lot on China. We are watching true superpower coming into being. I was just wondering what you felt about the attitude towards China. I mean, China is now, or Chinese companies, semi-state-owned or in some kind of state something, are buying up companies in the US, in Europe. Do you feel that the EU should have been somehow more apprehensive as to, let's say, human rights or simply ownership ideas, or does that matter?
Yes. Robert?
Shall we collect?
Charles Grant, Centre for European Reform. My question follows on from the previous one. Robert, you are, amongst other things, an expert on East Asia. Do you see any evidence that East Asia is moving from a modern system to a postmodern system? Or to put it another way, does East Asia today more closely resemble Europe in 1910 on the brink of disaster, or Europe in 1950 on the brink of a move towards integration?
Gentleman on the gallery there.
You mentioned the importance of legitimacy for Europe, and the European also talked about the importance of legitimacy for all the modern states that we have in crisis states. What sources do you see for legitimacy if you see that in many regions governments maintain legitimacy and resist to the region? I'm not only talking about Iraq, but also Kosovo.
Question over here.
Then I'll deal with it.
Yeah,
okay. Yes. You talked a lot about soft power in your speech, and I was wondering if you thought that the European Union had the will to use such soft power in countries such as Belarus to support government change, and if so, will that soft power be successful in such an operation?
I start with the two questions about China and about East Asia. I think the answer to both of them is this. It seems to me that this is an area which is very fluid at the moment, in which you can imagine very many different kinds of futures. I personally think that the question of human rights in China, taking human rights in a rather broad sense, with meaning rule of law, democracy, human rights, I think that's a critical question for us now. Human rights in Burma, which I'm personally very, very attached to, is a human rights question, but human rights in China is a strategic question, and I think that we ought to take it very seriously indeed. But I think it's very difficult to impose that kind of thing on people. How do you persuade the Chinese? I don't know. You try. You demonstrate that it works. You demonstrate that it's a part of, you persuade them that this is a part of being a well-functioning, respectable modern state. I think that's the best you can do. Example is very important. So I applaud the Senate for the decisions it made yesterday on torture. East Asia as a whole, modern or postmodern, still looks to me pretty modern, though I'm attracted by what might be happening on the Korean Peninsula between North and South Korea. We'll see. The legitimizing intervention, and how do you legitimize intervention in a way that doesn't attract what are sometimes called terrorists and sometimes called insurgents and sometimes called resistance movements or freedom fighters. I think one answer I give, this is not a very, it's not a very well thought out answer, is to say get out quickly. on day one you may, if you're lucky, be showered with flowers. By 6 months later, there will be some bombs among the flowers. If there is some compelling reason, then I think get your military power out rather quickly. It may be better even to leave a slightly anarchic situation behind than to remain, because sometime you're going to have to get out anyway. But I think there's probably no general answer. I think every intervention is different, and it's perhaps a mistake to try and make a general. I don't know what would have happened if we'd intervened in the right time in Rwanda. I know we could have done it with very small forces. European soft power on Belarus. For me,
the great source of soft power in European Union is the offer of membership. I think we're a long way from that with Belarus. I think we will try different things with Belarus. Actually, I spent the morning discussing, among other things, Belarus with Ukraine. And we have lots of ideas. We'll try lots of things, and the Commission is about to finance broadcasting into Belarus from Deutsche Welle. Ukrainians are setting up another radio station themselves. In the end, I think economic change is probably a big motive. If you can get the business community to see an interest in change, then you're likely to do it. Not a good answer.
I'll take one more very quick round, and then we'll have to close, I think, because we're tiring our poor speaker out. Gentleman on the far left in the gallery.
No, sorry, but I'll answer that question later.
Okay. One from over here. No. Middle there.
I'm just wondering if, with the spread of the European model, is there a danger in certain regions these blocks forming quite arbitrarily? For example, with the African Union, you have North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, which I think are quite different regions. I just wondered if you could talk about that.
Gentleman there.
Robert Kizik, Department of International Relations. If in your first stage model of self-determination, the 20th century was also the period of modern states and of modernity, and your second stage is the European model with postmodern states, what role does that leave for the United Nations, which, as you say, is of the modern era?
Gentlemen there.
Does the EU, what's the EU's position on the UN Security Council reform?
Gentlemen at the back.
I'd be grateful if you'd expand a little bit more on your answer about which you referred to the Deutsche Welle broadcasting into Belarus. I mean, in recent years, countries like the UK and US have started taking strategic communications and public diplomacy and so on more seriously, I mean, largely in the context of the war on terrorism. Is this a path that you think the EU should go down, and if so, how?
Finally, lady at the back there, yeah? And then I'm afraid we'd better call it a day.
You had mentioned that China should establish whether it wants to be more like the EU or US. How do you envision, or what brand of power do you envision Russia to choose?
Can I just ask this gentleman up here who was trying to get in, and I think I've been rather rude to him. Closing series of difficult questions there.
I think the answers are going to be rather short. An end to deepening? No, I don't think so. I think that there was some very good stuff in the misleadingly named constitution. I think the name was a mistake, maybe a fatal mistake. The content was actually rather modest and rather sensible, and I regret that probably it's not going to happen now. I think quite a lot of it will happen some way, maybe in little treaties or something like that. So I think that I think there is more to come, and I think that it's compelled partly by enlargement. As you get larger, you need to make the institutions function a bit differently. 25 is different, 15 will be 30 quite soon. So enlargement, widening and deepening go together. Now, eventually, if enlargement peters out, which I think is the more likely way that it will happen, then it may be that other institutional change will peter out and we'll reach a reasonably stable situation as states reach. This was a question which the idea of blocks becoming kind of too inclusive, including like the African Union might work better if it was sub-Saharan only. Was that the intent of the question? Oh yeah, how do you define the community that you're going to? Yes, I mean that's a fundamental question. And the answer is you define it, you decide. The fundamental political question is who is we? And that's a fundamental question for the European Union. I am very glad that we have answered, as far as Turkey is concerned, we've made clear that we are not excluding Islamic states or states with Islamic populations. But it's clear that if you try to define the community too wide, then you lose cohesion. There must be some sense of commonality. And there was, I think, a feeling, and it showed up a bit in the referenda, that that was being lost. I think that a bit of time is needed for people to get to know each other and the new member states better. If I see on British TV programs about how to buy property in Estonia, so looks to me as though we are going to get to know each other better, and then people feel more comfortable and more willing to take some more risks. What role do I allocate to the UN? I think that my real answer is, first of all, a long residual role in dealing with the problems of the modern era of warring states. It's going to go on for a long time in some parts of the world. Secondly, ultimately, if there was ever going to be, and this kind of answers another question, well, if there was ever going to be a real big UN reform one day, far into the future, then the Security Council would consist of representatives of the main regional organizations. I can imagine a Security Council in which the Latin American Union, the Asian Union, the South Asian Union, the European Union, the African Union are represented. That would be a Security Council that would fit the world that I dream of. But I think that's a dream.
Somewhere away.
Yes. By the way, I just point out in passing, no one's asked the question, but I just point out in passing the curious paradox that the Arab League hasn't worked. If you look at any part of the world where you ought to be able to form a union, you've got a single language group, a single culture, right across the Middle East, and it hasn't functioned. Whereas Europe, all of those languages, all of those histories, very extraordinary that it's meant it. The UN, the European Union, and the Security Council. Answer is very simple. Germany wants to become a permanent member of the Security Council. Italy doesn't want Germany to become a permanent member of the Security Council because that would be seen in Italy as a kind of humiliation. So there's no European position on the membership of the Security Council. And the pain of the one loser is always greater than the joy of the winner. As Schopenhauer said, the animal being eaten suffers more than the animal eating gets enjoyment from it. The European Union European Union using more strategic communication, that kind of thing. In this media world, in the world of instant communications, it's become much, much more important. I'm still, though, media, you know, explaining yourself internationally has become much more important. And the press is a bigger and bigger actor all the time in anything that we do. In the Versailles conference, Woodrow Wilson took control of all of the transatlantic cable networks to ensure that no news reached the United States without the State Department knowing about it. Can't do that today. Can you influence the world by controlling the media? I'm a bit skeptical. I think people are pretty quick to spot propaganda. I think doing the right thing and getting the story out is the way in which you do it. In the end, control of the media doesn't help. Even Mr. Berlusconi seems to be sinking in the polls. I hope this isn't all recorded. I talked about China. What future do I foresee for Russia? In a way, my guess is for Russia. Of course, you know, things can always go wrong, but my guess for Russia is I don't see as like Roger. I don't see Russia as a member of the European Union. It's too big. We're a union of kind of small to medium-sized states, and Russia is just too big for that. But I see Russia as becoming a more European state eventually. It'd take time, but I think that's what they want. Well, you know what I'm not a demographer. I do know that the I remember looking at demographic projections once and noting that the error in the projection 50 years ahead was greater than the total world population today. So they're not all that certain. If Russia's a success economically, it will attract the population, just as Europe will as well. And Turkish population growth will stop at some point, quite dramatically, as it has in other European countries. Croatia and the Western Balkans and Kosovo. I think you get Roger or someone to organize another lecture. too much, but I think that I am enormously encouraged by what's happened in the Western Balkans in the last week. Carla Del Ponte's report that Croatia is in full cooperation with the Hague Tribunal, I think, is an enormous success. The police reform we can now foresee in Bosnia is a very vital element in putting the Bosnian jigsaw back together. Later we'll have an opinion from the Commission on Macedonia and enlargement. So I actually feel this week rather optimistic about the Balkans. About Kosovo, we await the report of Kai Ida.
Well, it only remains to me to thank Robert for what post-war Foreign Secretary in Britain, Ernie Bevin, always used to describe to his officials as one of them tours of the horizons. it really has been extremely good and very, 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 very stimulating. Another opportunity to be stimulated is next Monday when Christine Lagarde, the excellent French trade minister, is speaking here at 6:30, but this time in the old theatre in the old building. So thank you very much, Robert, and thank you all for staying the course.